Thank you, David. I just hope that since this talk has been sitting in my drawer for about 6 weeks that it hasn't gone off in the meantime. What I would like to talk about is the holographic principle, and it's within the context of string theory, and in particular in the context of one of the more recent developments in string theory, perhaps not the most recent, but it's been called many things, ADS, EFT, and the gravity gauge correspondence. And so what I'd like to just do is start out by telling you what is the holographic principle, or sort of what's the motivation for it, and then say something a little more general about quantum gravity and the degrees of freedom of quantum gravity in the context of string theory. I should mention just before I get any further that there are other approaches to quantum gravity, such as the loop quantum gravity approach and so forth, quantum geometry, but I'm no expert in those, so I won't be able to speak on that topic. I'll just be talking about the string theory aspects of the holographic principle. And then I'll go on to introduce string theory, just to say some basic properties about it. I'm sorry to a bunch of you in the audience who are going to be bored by this, but this was supposed to be a general talk, so just cope with being bored. Talk about the spectrum of string theory, the kinds of objects we have to play with, building gauge theories in string theory, and how you build space-times. And then I'll get on to talking about space-time singularities, which is an issue that I've been thinking about with some other people here at ITP in the context of this gravity gauge correspondence. And then I'll just give a flavor for some of the actual stringy phenomena that can happen in string physics, and then get on to describing the correspondence that has got people so excited over the last several years or so. And hopefully if I have time at the end, I'll be able to describe in a pretty broad brushstrokes kind of fashion some stuff about a paper that I wrote with Joe Fortinsky and Clifford Johnson, who's now at the University of Durham. I'll also just mention, for those of you that care about units, that h bar and c will be, and Boltzmann constant will be equal to 1. That all formulas will be also invariant under Susskind transformations, in which 2 pi and I and so on are all equal to 1. I will, however, keep the Newton constant quite explicit, so I won't be working in usual sort of general relativist units. Let me just start with saying what this holographic principle is and where it really came from. Back in the 70s, a really important discovery of Stephen Hawking's led us to a formula for the entropy of a black hole. You can read this as either Bekenstein-Hawking entropy or black hole entropy. And it was found to be the area of the horizon, the event horizon of the black hole, divided by 4 times the Newton constant. Again, I'm leaving out factors of C and H bar. One of the things that you'll notice about this formula is that it's extensive in the area of the system. So if we had a system, for example, of volume V with an area, which is like the boundary, the area of the system, then the point is that in thermodynamics, usually, you would think that the entropy would be extensive. It would scale like the volume. But in this case, in this gravitational system with this black hole, it scales like the area. So this suggests that there's a very big redundancy in the d-dimensional degrees of freedom that we're using to describe this gravitational system. If we only need a set of area degrees of freedom to describe the entropy, why bother with a whole bulk volume set of degrees of freedom? So this was elevated to a holographic principle by people like Atuft and Susskind, and this is actually a conjecture that the degrees of freedom of a d-dimensional system with gravity don't actually need the full bulk to describe them. They are actually given by a d minus one dimensional system without gravity. And not having the gravity is kind of important because then you would have something like a quantum field theory, and we all know that in quantum field theory, the entropy should be extensive in the volume. That was sort of the intuition that we had to start with. Okay. So Bekenstein had argued, in addition to this stuff about the entropy, that this bound should actually be, this entropy should be a bound on the amount of entropy that could be contained in a region of volume V in area A. And there were a number of thought experiments that were done to see if you could squeeze any more entropy into that area on volume, that compact region, than the black hole entropy, and the answer seemed to be no. But one of the things that's perhaps not commonly known about the Bekenstein bound is that actually it's not generally true. So the Bekenstein bound people see if I write down that far? But Bekenstein actually requires what's called limited self-gravity. And so there are examples of systems in just in the context of general relativity where it doesn't apply. They might be closed universes or regions inside the horizon of a black hole and so on. And that led Raphael Bousso to come up. Well, it's basically a definition of systems for which the Bekenstein bound doesn't work. But, you know, a Friedman-Robinson-Walker cosmology with a closed universe would be another example of such a thing. The idea there that is the gravity is the dominant force that's really, you know, making things happen. Probably somebody else in the audience is more of an expert than I am and could give a better definition. But anyway, Raphael Bousso, who will be coming to ITP as the new five-year fellow in the fall, last year enunciated a more general and a covariant entropy bound. In that case, in his construction, you had to be a bit more careful about defining the areas of surfaces that you would include in counting the entropy of the system. And by being very careful about that, he managed to come up with a more general entropy bound that applies to all situations in which there are none. And this is a semi-classical bound. And what's meant by this is that you can consider doing quantum mechanical stuff with the matter fields in the system, like the things that contribute to the stress energy tensor, but you should always treat the gravity classically. You don't know, in this situation, there's no statement about what happens when the notion of geometry itself breaks down. So suppose we want to ask what this holographic principle really means in a quantum gravity context. How do we address this problem? This bound that we have seems to be obeyed in all situations that we can apply it to and think about. But we'd like to know whether this is really a fundamental law or not. And if we want to know if it's fundamental, we should actually have a theory of quantum gravity and ask if there's some sort of notion that can be extended. Now, the way I like to think about the Bousso bound, just out of interest, is that it's probably a semi-classical proxy for a fundamental law. If we could really formulate the fundamental laws, it might well be that we would find that this bound would be respected in all situations in which it is actually applicable. So, okay. How about the degrees of freedom of quantum gravity? Well, you've probably seen this diagram that Joe Kolchinsky drew many times. There's five different types of string theories that live naturally in 10 dimensions. And they're all connected by a bunch of dualities that we've been discovering over the last 6 years or so. And one of the ways in which we had information that came into this was thinking about things like quantum gravity and the black hole information problem. There was a lot of work being done on classical geometries in string theory. And there are higher dimensional generalizations of black holes that are called black P-brains. I'll say a little bit more about that later. Some of the other information that went into constructing this unified picture of string theories and how they all talk to each other was the dynamics of supersymmetric gauge theories. The reason we do supersymmetry is that it's a technical tool that allows us to say more about a theory quantum mechanically than we could if we didn't have supersymmetry. And of course, one of the initial motivations for string theory and so on is trying to unify the standard model with gravity to come up with a fully unified description of the universe. So you've probably seen something like this in previous broad brushstroke talks on string theory, but there is a much newer kind of duality that is not included on this picture, and it's given the name most generally, I guess, by the gravity gauge theory correspondence. And one example of this correspondence that you might have heard about is the ADS-CFT correspondence, and I'll say more about that later. But the important point about it for the context of my talk is that it provides concrete examples of this idea of holography. Basically, that the degrees of freedom of a system in D dimensions that has gravity are given by a lower dimensional theory which doesn't. So you've got higher dimensional gravity. This is a theory that has a bunch of degrees of freedom and so on. that turns out to be exactly equivalent to some lower dimensional gauge theory. Or in the generalizations, it's a sort of a generalization of the gauge theory that you have to use if you go to higher dimensions. Now, on the face of it, this looks like a totally crazy idea, that these two theories can be equivalent, and it was a very surprising correspondence when it was first proposed in its original form by Juan Malacena. But I hope as I go along later in the talk, when I get to the actual details of how this came about, I can convince you that it's actually somewhat plausible and not totally, totally idiotic. But one of the things that is important about this duality, as in some other dualities, is that it's a strong weak coupling duality. And what that means is that the degrees of freedom over here are nice and perturbative, and I can define the diagrams with them and understand the theory very well using a perturbative approach. The theory that it's dual to is actually very strongly coupled and out of control, and I can't use perturbation theory. And so there is never a situation in these gravity gauge correspondences where we have two descriptions that are weakly coupled. So it's very important somehow that this duality makes sense, is that one of them is strongly coupled and the other one is weakly coupled, and vice versa. Because if that weren't the case, we could derive some contradictions. So I hope this just gives you some introduction to the fact that this is a quantum gravity context in which I can explore some puzzles that I might be interested in, such as the black hole information problem. So these are some things that I would like to solve. I've no doubt that many other string theorists would like to solve this one, and not just string theorists. But also another thing that bothers us a lot when we consider semi-classical gravity is what to do with singularities. We get these mathematical singularities, for example, at the middle of a black hole, and we usually have no idea what to do with them. So the hope is that the string theory context will tell us the answer. Okay, so let me just go on to telling you some basic things about string theory that will be relevant later in my talk. So are there any questions so far? I guess I haven't really said very much except sort of introduce what I'm going to say, but people should feel free to interrupt me. Well, I will have something to say about that later on. To answer your question by jumping ahead a little bit, if you accept that the AD of CFD duality is actually true, like if you imagine that it's somehow going to be proven someday, then the answer is yes, for black holes that live in asymptotically anti-Cassiter spaces of certain dimensions, then in principle the black hole information problem is solved. But, you know, it's one of those things that we think should be true on the basis of the duality that we've got a lot of evidence for, but it's not by any means proved. And there could be, for example, a phase transition going in between the weak coupling picture in gravity and the strong coupling picture, which is described by this gauge theory, that we don't know about, and there could be some complications that mean that we really do lose information and so on. So I would say that there's some evidence that there is a duality that does provide a solution of the information problem, but it's certainly not as well established as some other facts that we know about in theoretical physics. So there has been a lot of noise about the gravity gauge correspondence solving the information problem, but actually, well, it's hard to actually get results. Because the strong weak thing hits you in the head, if, for example, you're describing a situation where the black hole is approximately semi-classical, you can't do anything with the gauge theory and vice versa. But that's jumping ahead. What I'd like to do is just say a little bit about the kinds of objects we have in string theory and what we have to work with, in other words. So the basic objects in string theory are these little fundamental strings, and they can either be closed strings or they can be little open strings. And typically the size of them is given by a parameter that we call L string. This has the dimensions of a length, and you can convert it into a tension if you like. So the tension of this little string in units where h bar and c are equal to 1 goes like 1 over L string squared. So the point is that this is going to be just a length scale that will tell us roughly about how stringy this string really is. And also the open string has roughly a length scale of order the string length. This is just a characteristic scale. There will, of course, be more interesting physics. So we have this length scale L string to work with. And there's also a coupling constant, which would, for example, describe a string theory analog of a Feynman diagram for one closed string to turn into two closed strings. And so we have another parameter to play with in the theory, which is G-string. So why is the string theory at all useful? Why is it interesting? You know, why are we bothered so much about it? Well, one of the things we can ask is, what are the lightest modes of the theory? These would be the ones that you would expect to be useful at low energies, by comparison to the energy scale set by this string scale. So if we're considering energies much less than the inverse string length, then we should get back what we had before, and indeed that's true. You get essentially some modification of general relativity plus some extra matter. And one of the reasons that this happened is that there is a massless state in the spectrum of closed strings, which has spin 2, and it turns out to be the graviton. So the point is that this is the guy that describes gravity. Incidentally, this was the reason why string theory was thrown away as a theory of QCD. It was originally studied as a possible theory of the strong interactions, and then they discovered that there was this spin 2 massless state in the spectrum. It was very embarrassing, and it turned out to be no good for QCD, and it took a number of years later before people realized that they should actually treat that as a good thing. So we have this gravitational field in the massless state, and if you consider the lowest mode, in other words, the massless mode of the open string, it gives rise to a gauge field. So back here I talked about a correspondence between a system with gravity and a system with gauge theories. So the first thing you might ask is, well, how do we build gauge theories in string theory? And one of the things that we need is a piece of the spectrum that is actually a non-perturbative part of that spectrum. And here there are the things that Joe Bolkinski taught us about, that they carry charge. These are the D-brains of the system. And essentially what this is it's just a higher dimensional hypersurface, like a generalization of a membrane, and that's why it's called a brain. The D has to do with some of the specifics of the string, the string theory. Okay. So one of the things that we might ask is, you know, what's a D-brain and what's its tension and so forth? And the D-brain is actually a place where open strings end. So if we've got open strings, technically this occurs in the type 2A, type 2B theories to be precise, but if we've got open strings, they have to end on the D-brains. Okay. And these endpoints of the strings turn out to be able to carry gauge labels for free. It doesn't cost any energy to put these gauge labels on them. So what this actually enables the little strings to do is to tell which brain they're ending on. For example, if you had two D-brains, you would ask the little string, well, which one does he end on? He's got the possibility of starting on this one and ending on it, or going from one to the other, or starting and ending on the same brain. And this gives rise to carrying what is actually the adjoint representation of the UM. So, okay, the fact that we have this open string lowest mode, which is the gauge field, and the fact that there's these gauge labels, and the fact that they're on the endpoints which have to end on the D-brains, all of this information can be bundled together to say that we actually get a UN gauge theory that lives on the brains, the D-brains to be precise. So this is how in string theory you end up getting gauge theories that live in a certain number of dimensions which will be given by the dimensions of the brain. And so if you were interested in writing down some Lagrangian for the low energy modes of this system, you would get some Yang-Mills theory, UN Yang-Mills theory. And the coupling constant is a derived quantity here. And we have to be able to build it out of those basic quantities that we started with, the thing that characterizes the tension of the string, and the coupling constant that tells us about the string interactions. So if you've got a P-brain, this would just be the number of space dimensions of the string, then the Yang-Mills coupling is given by taking one power of the string coupling constant and adding enough powers of the string length to get a dimensionally correct number. Okay, so this is essentially the idea of how we get gauge theories living in string theory. Well, what about gravity theory? Well, the Newton constant is also a derived quantity in string theory. So if we're interested in, for example, writing down the Newton constant appropriate to the 10-dimensional system where the strings naturally live, we have to use two powers of the string coupling constant and add enough powers of the string length to make a direct dimensionally correct number. So this is the idea. You've got these two basic things that you can play with, but if you want to build things of interest to you, like gauge theories and spacetimes, the constants that tell you about how strong those gauge theories and spacetime couplings are, you have to build them out of the basic quantities. Okay, so this is basically how we get the gauge theories and the spacetimes that will be a part of this gravity gauge theory correspondence. The thing to notice is that if we are interested in building a space-time, for example, a classical space-time, we're talking about a classical gauge theory, there are these, just to reiterate it, there are these two things that are involved in quantum corrections to the classical physics. All right, so instead of just having one coupling constant to do Feynman diagrams with, we've got two coupling constants, and so we have to do two perturbation extensions to ask about those corrections. So now I can just make a remark about the actual topic that I'm interested in this context, and that is, suppose we have a singularity in the space-time. How are we going to fix it? What's string theory going to do for us? Well, string theory is supposed to be this fundamental theory of everything, so it should tell us what to do. And when we're building classical space-times in string theory, like, for example, the Schwarzschild black hole or some high-dimensional generalization of it or some black hole which has a whole lot of other quantum numbers on it, when we're building these classical space-times, we make use often of a thing called a Mohair theorem. What this basically tells us is that if we end up with a space-time, say we get a horizon, this is supposed to be a black hole, I'm not very good at drawing, so that's, you just have to believe me that it's a black hole, but suppose we specify some conserved quantum numbers on that black hole, like the mass, or the charge, or the angular momentum, or whatever else happens to be available, then if we end up getting a nasty, horrible singularity at the center of that space-time, if it's covered by an event horizon, then we're okay. And then the Mohair theorem tells us that this geometry is unique. In other words, we've got the right answer. But if, after solving all those disgusting differential equations, we end up with something that doesn't have an event horizon, we've just got some horrible singularity sitting in the middle of space-time, then we don't even know if we've got the right answer, because these classical Mohair theorems break down. There's no way that we can know that our geometry is unique. So if we find some solution, we have no idea what we're talking about. So one thing that you might ask is, suppose we have singularities, how does string theory fix up these singularities? Well, the answer that you will have heard most often is that string theory smooths them out. So instead of having a disgusting point singularity that you don't know what to do with, the idea is that string theory will somehow provide stringy degrees of freedom, which will smooth it out into a sort of finite region of bounded curvature, and you'll know what to do. But in a paper a few years ago, Horowitz and Myers pointed out something very important, which is that string theory doesn't know how to fix some singularities because they are illegitimate singularities and they shouldn't be allowed in the first place. So let me just explain an example of what I might mean by that. So suppose we take a Schwarzschild black hole, something that has some coefficient like the time-time component of the metric is 1 minus 2gm over r. Hopefully that might look familiar. But the idea is if we take a negative mass Schwarzschild black hole, then there won't be any horizon, because the horizon, if the mass is negative, would be at a negative radius, which doesn't make any sense. So what we would have in this situation is a horrible, disgusting singularity sitting at the origin of space-time and no horizon to clothe it. So then, what do we do about this? Well, suppose that string theory fixes the singularity by making it into this little region of finite and bounded curvature. Okay. Well, then we would have a situation in which there would be a big space-time, and it would have overall a negative mass, and it would be well-behaved. Well, this is a disaster, because the vacuum, which has no mass at all, would be unstable to falling apart into bunches of these little guys, these little stable negative mass objects. So this is a situation in which string theory doesn't just smooth out the space-time singularity, but it demands that this kind of thing should never happen in the first place. So the way that we should find string theory addresses the problem with this negative mass Schwarzschild black hole is that it can never form. We can't create it in the first place. So it's illegal. Okay, so that's basically the introduction for the question that I'm asking. So before I go on to telling you about the gravity gauge correspondence and some of the interesting things that we've been learning about it lately, I just want to point out a fairly basic fact about string theory that should enable you to get a handle on how string theory might fix up problems like singularities. So one of the things you can ask about string theory to see if it's different from what we know in quantum field theory is to ask, suppose we do a scattering process and we have some momentum for our little probe, the thing that we're throwing at our target, and we obtain some effective size for that target. Well, one of the things we know in quantum field theory is if we draw a graph of the effective size that we see of the target versus the uncertainty in the momentum, is that it obeys this inverse relationship. As you crank up the momentum of the probe, you get a better and better resolution on what's going on in the target. Well, this we encode by writing down the uncertainty relation, which is like that, but the point in string theory is that it's different from ordinary field theory and something different happens here. What we get is an extra term, which is proportional to this stringy length parameter, and there's a term linear in the momentum. So what that means is instead of getting better and better resolution as we crank up the momentum, it goes down to about a minimum, and then it starts to rise again. And this takes place at about what you would expect, the characteristic stringy scale. Now, what this means is that if you've got some target, like this, and you're throwing a little string probe at it, you can never learn with this probe any more information than what's associated with the characteristic scale of the probe. And of course, the reason why this happens is as you pump more and more energy into this little probe, first of all, you win because you start going down this part of the curve, but after a while, you get to the characteristic energy scale of the excitations of the string. And so as you pump more and more energy, the string doesn't stay small anymore because it can't. It's too energetic. It starts to get excitation, it starts to get bigger and bigger, so the actual probe itself is getting bigger. So obviously with a big probe, you can't see anything that's too small. So this is one way in which string theory is really quite different from quantum field theory, in that you've got this basic minimum distance scale sitting in your system. So you've got minimum distance, it's about of order L string. This is for a string probe. Now, as we saw before, we had different objects in the string theory spectrum, and some of them are D brains. For example, we might have what we call a D0 brain, which is a point particle with the property that open strings end on it, like this. And if we were to throw this at a target, because it's got different ways of interacting with things like strings, it doesn't give rise to exactly the same minimum distance scale. So different objects in string theory will give rise to a different minimum distance, but if you choose, you specify the probe to be a wee string, then this is the answer for the minimum distance scale. Okay, so I'll just mention that it's important that the string is an extended object for this to happen. Another way in which you can see that this stringy phenomenon that I'm talking about happens is if you roll up some space dimension of space-time and you put it on a circle of radius r. Then what you find is that there's a symmetry of the theory in which you interchange that radius in string units with its inverse. Okay, and in some sense this means that the smallest distance that you can really get in terms of this dimension that's rolled up on a circle of radius r is the string scale. Because if you make that radius smaller than the string scale, then there's another picture in which the string scale is big again. So that's a sort of a manifestation of the same phenomenon. And in fact, what happens in this symmetry is that we exchange some different kinds of modes. So let's consider the example where we have a point particle which lives on a circle. And we know that you have to put an integer number of de Broglie wavelengths around that circle in order to satisfy the conditions. And so you have a bunch of modes that have an energy that goes like 1 over the radius. As the radius gets smaller, those modes get more and more expensive. And with the string, we can have the same thing, because this little string can just go round and round the circle. But when we have the string, which is an extended object, it can do something that a point particle can't do. It can wrap around this extra dimension. And so the modes that we have there, the energy of them, the mass energy, is proportional to the radius, because that's it's also proportional to the tension of the string. And the reason there is this symmetry is that you interchange these two kinds of modes. Okay, so let me get on now to telling you about the gravity gauge correspondence, which is the interesting part, I think. So far it's just been most of the introduction. Okay. So
One of the things I'll have to say a little bit about before I get there is to talk about black brains. And people often put a P in front because that just tells you how big the brain is. I had a story about the naming of this thing that I'm not sure is actually true, but Paul Townsend, who was one of the first people to write papers about black pea brains, which are basically just high-dimensional analogs of black holes, was giving some talk on it at Cambridge, and he called them K-brains because everyone knows, well, everyone who's a good Fortran programmer knows that K is an integer. And so it was obvious that K should be an integer, whereas P, of course, is not in any Fortran program, so that wouldn't be too good. And then apparently some bright spark at the back of the audience piped up that you should call them P-brains, and the name stuck. So I'd be interested if anybody can actually confirm or deny this story, whether it's true. Okay. So we know, presumably, that if we have four space-time dimensions and we ask what's the space-time geometry appropriate for having a certain mass, this would be the Schwarzschild black hole. And we end up with some pieces in the metric sensor that look like 1 minus 2 gm over r. And the reason why we have the 1 over r is simply that that's a Coulomb potential in four dimensions. So let's ask what we would get if we were to have, say, some, I can't draw the whole P then because it would fill up the board, but suppose we have P dimensions living, this brain has P dimensions, and it lives in a space-time dimension 10. Well, the way we got r over here is that we said that there are three dimensions transverse to this object. There's just three space dimensions that we have to worry about. And so if we ask about Gauss's law, we get a 1 over r potential. So what we should do here is we should ask, we've got nine space dimensions, and we should subtract p of them. And then by analogy, if we had three transverse dimensions and we end up getting a 1 over r potential here, we end up getting 1 over r to the 7 minus p potential over here. So just depending on which brain you have, how the gravitational field falls off far away from it just depends on how big the brain is. And an analogy to getting this kind of correction to the flat metric, which would just be like having a 1 there and nothing. You get for these brains something like the 1, which would tell you that it was flat space-time. And then you get something that tells you about the corrections to the flat metric that would fall off like 1 over r to the 7 minus p. And instead of having a mass here, you will get a mass per unit volume. And if you work out all the units, you have to have some powers of L string. And for the D brains, you get a power of the string coupling and a number of brains. So if there's n brains, more and more and more brains, then you have more and more mass, and so the gravitational field should be stronger. So this is the kind of space-time metrics that you see when you write down the geometry for these P brains. Now the point, the only point of introducing this was to tell you about the procedure for making these gravity gauge correspondences that we've all got so excited about. And one of the things you might consider doing, for example, is to take a special limit of this geometry so you can do something with it. So one of the things you might consider doing, for example, is to take the string coupling to zero, to turn off all the interactions, but keep all the other things in this formula fixed. If you keep the number of brains fixed and the string length fixed and you don't scale the radius in any special way, then what you would end up with is just the 1 in the metric. So you would have flat space-time and nothing particularly interesting happens. But the limit that has been used to build these gravity gauge theory correspondences is a different kind of limit. And the main point of this particular limit is that you take the stringiness parameter, this L string, to 0, but you fix the coupling constant for the Yang-Mills theory that lives on the brains. So this is just a particular way of taking a limit of the system. And then what happens, if you follow through all the algebra, I won't bother to do it for you now, but it turns out that then this piece of the geometry is unimportant. So you lost the part of the geometry that told you about the asymptotically far away flat piece of the geometry. So in this case, what you've done is you've zoomed in on the piece of the geometry which is in near the horizon of the black hole, the black P-brain. So this particular limit takes you to the near horizon region of the geometry. And so the space-time that you'll get will be different from the one you had originally, and the asymptotic properties will be quite different. So one of the things you might ask, well, that's what happened to the space-time. What happens to the actual brains? What happens to the gauge theory on the brains? Well, it turns out that when you take
this limit that the stringy parameter gets very small, that means that excitations of the string, in other words, wiggles as compared to just straight strings, are very expensive. And so you essentially turn off all of the whole infinite tower of string modes that you have to play with, you know, all these kinds of guys, this would be for open strings, you turn off all the stringiness part of the physics of the open strings. And so what you're left with on the brains is just this UN gauge theory. That's it. There's no corrections coming from the string physics. And so this particular limit here, there are a couple of other things you have to do, but I won't get into the details. This, we can use this procedure that I've been describing just to motivate how you would get a gauge theory and how you would get some near horizon space-time. So you get a gauge theory on the brains and you get the near horizon space-time. And then the question is, are they related somehow? And the answer is yes, in fact. So let me describe. I'll just mention one more thing before I do, and that is that I've said that the physics of the gauge theory on the brains is to do with the physics of the open strings, whose ends have to be on the D brain. And I've also mentioned that there are strings that can propagate in the bulk, in other words, in the whole space-time, they don't have to be restricted to the brain, but these modes like the supergravity fields and so on can be everywhere in space-time. And you might ask, well, isn't there a probability that this little string out here, who's happily propagating around in the bulk, might interact with one of these little open strings whose ends are stuck on the brain? And the answer is, actually, the special property about taking this limit is also that the probability for one of these modes to interact with one of these modes goes away. So the modes that are happily propagating around in the bulk and the modes that are happily stuck to the D brain don't talk to each other. So on the brain, we have this gauge theory, and it's happy if you scatter things in the brain, they don't leave and propagate out into the bulk. So if you consider this theory by itself, it's a perfectly happy unitary gauge theory with no stringiness attached. And on the other hand, if you're thinking about the space-time modes, they happily propagate around in the 10 dimensions, and they're propagating in this near-horizon geometry because we took this very special limit of the supergravity geometry. And they don't talk to each other. So we can consider each theory by itself as a complete unitary gauge theory. So I'll just mention what happens when you take the dimension of the brain to be the one that we might consider to be the most useful for our world, which is to take a three-dimensional brain. That would then mean that the gauge theory that lives on these brains is a 3+1-dimensional neural theory. And it turns out that just from the properties of string theory, you end up getting some supersymmetric gauge theory. So, of course, we realize that this is not particularly realistic for building theories of the real world, but it just is what we get when we do this whole procedure of taking this very special limit of a bunch of brains. And so what happens when we ask about the geometry? Well, the geometry that you get when you take this near horizon limit turns out to be an anti de Sitter space, and there's also a sphere involved. That would just be the sphere that tells you about the dimensions transverse to the brain. So if you, for example, had your little point mass in three dimensions, if you asked about how the field falls off, then you would be talking about two spheres in one place. This is just the piece that's transverse to the free brain, like the two-sphere transverse to the little black hole, and then there's an anti de Sitter space. And on the other hand, what you get when you ask what is the supersymmetric Yang-Mills theory, it turns out to have enough fermions in the gauge theory that the beta function is zero. So this is actually a theory that doesn't have any running of the coupling constant like QCD or something that you would normally talk about in trying to build theories of the real world, and it turns out to be a conformal field theory. And so the big insight that Nalbandian made was that these two theories are actually the same theory. And on the face of it, it seems kind of crazy that you could have a theory which has
10 dimensions, or if you did a Kaluza-Klein reduction on the sphere, that this would be a five-dimensional theory. And yet, on the other side, you have some actually superconformal field theory which lives in four dimensions. Now, one of the reasons that I think that this makes a little bit of sense as compared to, you know, just coming completely out of the blue, is that if you ask about the properties of anti-Grafitti space, it turns out to have a property that sort of motivates the fact that we've got a reduction by one dimension in the kinds of degrees of freedom that we're interested in. So one of the properties of the anti-Grafitti space is if you ask how the volume of that space scales, for example, as you go far out in the geometry, go very far away from the origin of anti-Grafitti space, you find out that it scales like the area. It's actually true for any anti-Grafitti space. Of course, there's going to be some coefficient in front to make the dimensions right. But this kind of property tells us that, in fact, this idea that this holographic principle is operating really is the case for anti-Grafitti space. The radius of curvature of the ADS. You have to have some dimensions in there to make it work, and that's essentially the only one that you have available. But I'm just trying to write this down as a property of anti-Grafitti space that might help you to believe that this correspondence here is not completely crazy. Well, another thing that I mentioned a bit earlier on was that we have two kinds of quantum corrections to classical space-time physics and string theory. One of them was these kinds of stringy corrections. And if we want to measure how strong those stringy corrections might be in a space-time geometry, we would ask, how is the scalar curvature or some invariant, how does that compare to the characteristic scale of string theory, characteristic scale of the stringiness parameter? And then we had this other coupling constant, which was this thing that told us how strong the string interactions were. And so we've got these two things that tell us how to turn on quantum corrections to this classical space-time that we got. Well, it turns out that in this correspondence, there are two parameters on the other side in the gauge theory that tell us about how to do perturbation expansions in this conformal field theory. And one of the things that I haven't written down, I think, except over there, is that we got this by taking a large number of zebrains. And so we've got this UN supersymmetric Yang-Mills theory that we're talking about. And one of the things that we know about these large N UN supersymmetric gauge theories, just you don't even have to have supersymmetry, is that when n is large, planar diagrams in the Feynman diagram expansion are suppressed. So you can ask about the 1 over n expansion in the gauge theory, and you can also ask in the same limit about the Etouffee coupling, which also tells you, it's a combination of the original coupling constant of the theory and n that also tells you about another expansion that you can do in that large n gauge theory. And it turns out that these two sets of parameters are actually related. So what it tells you, for example, is that if the space-time is very classical, so that these parameters are very small, these expansion parameters that tell you about quantum gravity are very small, then in the gauge theory, these coupling constants have to be very large. So whenever you're doing classical physics in the space-time, you're doing very, very quantum mechanical physics in the gauge theory. And there are two different expansions that correspond to two different aspects of the gauge theory. So are there any questions at this point? People are looking kind of stunned. So. Okay. Rightio. Well, one of the things that Hartle mentioned right near the beginning was, does this ADS-CFT correspondence, which has received so much press that there have even been articles in the New York Times about it, is that it helps us to understand some things about the black hole information problem. So you might ask, well, I've got this nice, happy anti-Grafitti space here. What happens with a black hole? How do I make a black hole in this area, in this context? Well, what I do is I just add some stuff. For example, if I've got a bunch of three brains, I just add some energy density to the three brains. And then what I get is a black hole living in this ADS 5. There's also a 5 sphere that goes along for the ride, but that's not hugely important. So what I then got on one side of the correspondence is a black hole in ADS 5, and this corresponds to finite temperature in the gauge theory.
Of course, adding a scale, which is namely the temperature, breaks the conformal invariance, but I've still got the same fuel content as I had before. Okay, so if I want to ask about the dynamics of black holes, all I have to do is to turn on finite temperature in this gauge theory. And so you might imagine that what this gives us is a way to study problems about black holes, including horizons, all that kind of stuff. And this is the mechanism by which people have claimed that the ADS-CFT correspondence, which is just one example of this gravity gauge correspondence, gives us a resolution in principle of the black hole information problem. So let's see why. If we had, for example, a black hole, and then we threw something into it, this should be described, albeit in a very, very different set of variables, by some process that corresponds to adding a little scattering state or something into a bunch of modes in the gauge theory which live at finite temperature. Now, the reason why we haven't actually been able to construct explicit solution to this black hole information problem that's appeared in PRL and so on is the problem that it's a strong weak coupling duality. So if we're interested in some process that involves a big semi-classical black hole where the curvatures of space-time are not stringy, they're not large, so we don't have to worry too much about quantum corrections in the region where we're throwing graduate students into the black hole to do the experiments, this is all described in a big sort of semi-classical kind of thing. So we don't have to worry about any of these quantum corrections here. But if we want to fully understand exactly how the gauge theory solves this information problem for us, you know, it's a unitary theory. You don't lose information when you talk about the dynamics of gauge theories. So if we want to describe what the process is of this graduate student falling into a black hole on this side, then unfortunately, because of this duality relationship between the coupling constants, if we want to calculate anything on the gauge theory, all the coupling constants that we've got are just enormous. So if we try to compute Feynman diagrams and so on in the gauge theory, then we're just lost. We don't know actually how to do those computations. So that's the reason why we haven't come up with, you know, perfect, very important papers on solving the black hole information problem in the context of this gravity gauge theory correspondence.
But doesn't mean that the pure states in the black hole correspondence definitely makes sense in those papers, that you mean by finite temperature. So for example, calculating these functions, if you calculate them, you're calculating.
No, actually. I mean, the precise statement of this is that if you add a uniform energy density to the brains, that corresponds to turning on a gas of photons in the gauge theory, and they live at a certain temperature. And what that corresponds to on the supergravity side is having an extra bit of energy density over what you would have had if you just had the brains, and that corresponds to having a black hole in the anti-de-Sitter space at the Hawking temperature, which is equal to the finite temperature in the gauge theory.
But the correlation functions finite temperature gauge theory, are they finite temperature in the sense of the Green's functions factor? Like the finite temperature steps, or is it some pure state that just happens to
I think maybe Gary wants to say something, but I don't think we
the latter. Look, I mean, a pure state on the gravity side would be a pure state on the gauge theory side if the theories are equivalent. So if you have a pure state which collapses to form a black hole, it'll be described by a state in the gauge theory, which is, you know, it's a pure state, but it's approximately thermal in the sense that, you know, expectation values of macroscopic observables will be, you know, very close to their thermal expectation values. If you actually put the gauge theory at finite temperature, it would be like putting the gravity side actually at finite temperature, and they're both in the state.
Right, but one of the questions you could ask, for example, we know that on this side a black hole has entropy. And that entropy corresponds if you fix the quantum, it all depends on what you hold fixed. So for example, if you fix the quantum numbers which are appropriate to this black hole, which in this case is just the mass, we know that there is a certain degeneracy of states if you just fix the mass, corresponding to all of the possible states that have the same mass but and the same Hawking temperature that, you know, contribute to the entropy. But then the point is that when you're talking about one pure state, that's not what you really mean when you're talking about the black hole that has all energy. The question of whether one particular pure state in the gravity really corresponds to your typical black hole, I think is something that people are still arguing about. You don't think that the black hole geometry necessarily describes every single pure state that you've got in this quantum gravity system. Yeah. People have different ideas on this, this point, I think.
I would say that the gravity, if you look at general relativity, you're already in something like a thermodynamic approximation. You've wiped out all the microscopic details between the quantum
state. The point being that if you're not keeping track of what's not in the Mohair theorem, I mean, the Mohair theorem just tells you that if you've just got semi-classical general relativity, then the geometry depends just on one thing, and there's this gigantic entropy. So on the gravity side, you're not keeping track of all of those things that tell you which particular pure state you might be talking about when you say you're talking about a black hole. So, yeah, it's, I guess that's the right way to say it. But in both cases, you're sort of talking about some sort of density matrix when you're talking about this black hole corresponding to the finite temperature and the gauge theory. But one of the things that you can do is ask, well, suppose we compute the entropy on this side, and we ask, does the entropy on the other side agree with it? And the answer is, they agree in terms of the way they scale with the temperature, but in fact the precise coefficients in front don't actually agree in that case. Okay, so what we've got in this setup is some physics as anti-de Sitter spaces. Of course, you can ask what happens when you take this special limit that I talked about that gives you near-horizon geometries and gauge theories living on the brains. You can ask what happens if you do it with other brains. You might want to pick a 2-brain or a 7-brain or something like that. And people have worked out the versions of the correspondences that work with all of these guys. They look different because the near-horizon geometry is not the same as anti-de Sitter space in these other cases, but it's known what happens with those other examples. And working out the details of how those correspondences work and how you can compare correlation functions on one side of a correspondence to correlation functions on the other side, and checking all sorts of relationships that might throw light on whether or not this duality is true. There's been a huge amount of work done on it, and nobody's managed to come up with a contradiction so far. So it seems as if this duality here, that this four-dimensional superconformal field theory is actually equivalent to this full string theory living in this anti-de Sitter space times the phi sphere is actually true. But we haven't got, you know, 100% confirmation that it would be extremely difficult to prove. So just in the few minutes that I've got left, I'd just like to give an example of how a gravity gauge correspondence such as this, especially a different one than the original one, can give you some insight on resolution of space-time singularities in the context of string theory as a theory of quantum gravity. So this is based on the paper that I wrote with Olchinsky and Johnson. So one of the things that's kind of problematic about using string theory to build these gauge theories is that we end up getting lots of supersymmetry. For example, over here, this is what's called n equals 4 supersymmetries. And in fact, the real world has n equals 0. We've got no supersymmetry at all. And so one of the things that people wanted to do after this correspondence was invented was to break some supersymmetry, to make gauge theories with less and less supersymmetry in the hope that we would eventually get down to having no supersymmetry at all, and then we might be able to use some sort of gravity dual to the gauge theory to tell us about confinement and QCD and so on. But to my knowledge, that hasn't really happened yet. So one of the examples that we wrote about was to take half of the supersymmetry in the system and to build it by using brains in this string theory context. So it turned out, in our example, it was simplest to build a 2 plus 1 dimensional gauge theory, just for technical reasons that I won't bore you with. And one of the ways that you can break supersymmetry is in string theory is, instead of just having a brain and just leaving it there sitting in 10 dimensions, is that you can wrap this brain on some weirdo string theory manifold that breaks half of the supersymmetry. So that's what we did in this case. We wrapped it on a strange-looking manifold. So we took a 6-brain and wrapped it on some 4-dimensional surface and made that surface really tiny, so we just ended up with a 2 plus 1 dimensional gauge theory. And you don't need to know anything about this surface except that it broke half of the supersymmetry. But the problem was, when we wrote down the space-time appropriate to this guy, of course it was a sort of a generalization of a black hole, we got a naked singularity. This is the classical space-time. And it was a very bad singularity. If you take this as the origin of space transits or the brain stuff, and it turned out that it happened at a radius which could be very large. So it happened at a radius which is
proportional to the atomic coupling with the gauge theory. So if you turned up the grains to be a large number of grains, then this was a really disgusting naked singularity sitting in space-time, one that you could, you know, reach out and touch, and you wouldn't know what to calculate there because everything was blowing up on you. So one of the questions that we asked was, well, is this naked singularity the kind of singularity that can actually be fixed in string theory? I mentioned earlier that there's two things that string theory can do to a naked singularity. It can smooth it out, fix it up, or it can make it completely illegal. And so we were worried that this naked singularity might be one of the kinds of singularities that is just completely illegal and isn't allowed, and we were just doing rubbish. So we actually found that it wasn't the case, and one of the ways that we did this was to take another little brain, in other words, something that's similar to all of the guys that were making this naked singularity in the first place, and we asked, can you bring this guy up? What does he feel when he comes up and tries to feel this horrible naked singularity stuff? And what we found is that he actually ended up hitting a wall when he got twice as far out as where the naked singularity was actually sitting. And after, you know, doing some string theory calculations and so on, we found that it was the fact that he hits the wall and he can't go inside and he can't go in and feel this disgusting naked singularity that's sitting on this sphere. We found the reason for this was actually this minimum distance phenomenon that I talked about way back. You know, I mentioned that when you have a circle in string theory or radius r, and you try to ask what's the minimum, how small can it be, well, we found that when the radius got down to be about the string size, then it started to get bigger again, effectively, as far as theory was concerned. And in fact, if you take all these duality transformations and you find that this is exactly the same phenomenon, just appearing in different clothing because we set it up in a different way. And so what this gave rise to was a kind of exclusion principle. The fact that if you try and bring one of these guys in who's trying to make a singularity, then he actually can't get close enough to the other guys to make a singularity. And in fact, what happened was instead of having a whole bunch of brains sitting at one particular place in the space-time making a nasty naked singularity at a certain radius, what we actually got was a situation where the brains sat on a kind of sphere. I couldn't draw enough of them to make a solid sphere, but you get the picture. The reason why there's no naked singularity is that it would have been inside, but by Gauss's law, if you have a whole bunch of mass sitting on a sphere, then the gravitational field looks exactly the same outside, but inside it's flat space-time. And so this was I just wanted to mention this because this was one particular example of how string theory fixes up some really revolting naked singularity just because of this effect of minimum distance that exists in string theory. So this effectively stringy phenomenon is what saved us from having a really horrible naked singularity in the space-time. So I guess that's pretty much what I have to say.
Okay, I have a feeling that the non-string theorists might have some questions.
I hope they do. Are there any non-string theorists here?
Sure. Does anyone ever do numerical calculations in string theory?
Yes.
What kind of things do people try to calculate? Look, you've described a lot of analytical theory.
Yeah.
What it looks like. I'm saying, how would you use a computer?
I can give one.
Okay.
Answer because I've done one. So because of this, it is to people start as you can string theory in a yes problem with the gauge theory, and then the problem with gauge theory is the one direction that you can take is this. So the answer is any equal forces in the milk theory in scope of extracting some information about the string theory as well. That's one of the examples.
Something like a lattice gauge theory calculation.
Like a lattice gauge theory calculation.
One of the things you might, for example, ask is what is the physics of blue balls in this gauge theory? I mean, it's not the real gauge theory, so it's not quite as good as QCD because it's got way too much supersymmetry. But you might ask, suppose there's different excitations of the non-abelian degrees of freedom that give you glue balls of different masses, and you might ask, well, how about we compute some of those ratios of masses? And we would do that in the context of the large N gauge theory, and that gets computationally difficult because you're doing large N, but maybe you've got some computer algorithm that does that for you. And then you would ask, what is the analogous thing that corresponds to the global mass on the gravity side? And there, the neat thing is that you just have to use some aspect of the space-time to extract what the global mass should be. And so people, one of the things that people did when this correspondence was still a bit newer was to run off and do loads and loads of calculations to compare what the spectrum of blue balls on this side and saying what does it correspond to in the gravity. And that was just one example where the computers are useful. Yeah?
Can you phrase the cosmic censorship hypothesis precisely in the language of string theory?
It's pretty much the same thing, but I would just like to mention this important thing that Horowitz and Myers pointed out. I mean, it's not just the case of string theory fixing up classical nastiness. There might be situations in which the classical nastiness goes away, not because some stringy effect of degrees of freedom smooth out that disgusting classical singularity, but there might be this thing might be prevented from happening in the first place. And so that might be some aspect of the statement of how string theory enforces cosmic censorship, that it doesn't allow these singular geometries that would have given rise to this instability of the vacuum that I talked about. So my personal expectation is that string theory doesn't allow really disgusting vacuum singularities at which we don't know how to calculate, because that would be a sort of giving up of the idea that we want string theory for in the first place. We want it to be the fundamental theory. So in every possible situation that string theory creates, we should be able to have some way of calculating what happens. Okay? Whereas with a classical naked singularity, the reason that general relativity doesn't know what to do there is that it's just a classical theory. It doesn't know how to tell us what the quantum corrections are that might help us calculate what, for example, the mass of the electron is at the singularity, or some property or some physical thing that we can measure. So the idea is that string theory is supposed to be this all-encompassing theory. And in all of the different situations that we derive by taking limits of certain things or, putting different charges on black holes and so on, it's supposed to tell us what to do. Now, the problem is that string theory and string theorists is a bit like the proverbial blind man and the elephant at the moment, that we've got this great big enormous theoretical structure and we've learned little bits about the elephant. So we know about its tail and its toenails and its nose and all this trunk and all this kind of stuff. But we haven't put the full picture together. And so if you ask me to compute what's going on at the knee of the elephant, where the knee might be some thing that I don't yet know how to compute, I might not have a good perturbation expansion. And so I might not be able to tell you what the physics is near the knee of the elephant, but maybe in 10 years we will have figured out more about this whole elephant so that we'll be able to say, oh, I know what to do at the knee of the elephant. I can use such and such theory with this number of matter fields and 10 D brains and all that kind of thing. So at the moment we're still sort of learning little bits about this whole ginormous string theory, N theory, brain theory, whatever you like to call it these days. But the expectation is that the theory is big enough that it can handle all the situations that it finds itself in. That there will be some degrees of freedom. We can change variables to some degrees of freedom that will allow us to calculate everywhere on the elephant. Of course, those degrees of freedom might look very different. Up here I might be using 10-dimensional gravity, and over here I might be using 3-dimensional gauge theory. But the idea is that there should be some set of degrees of freedom that I can use to do calculations. But that's sort of a philosophy, I guess. I don't know if it actually answered your question, but... For example, this one that I was just trying to explain here, where we thought that this geometry was formed by having all the brains sit at the same place. But what actually happened is that they got spread out. There were some sort of repulsive forces that didn't allow them to get close enough to each other that they would actually make the naked singularity. So the point is that this is one of the naked singularities that you just think is there if you do the semi-classical calculation, but you're actually wrong if you take into account this fundamentally stringy minimum distance phenomenon that I talked about with my scattering amplitudes and my things rolled up on circles, then you find it's not really there anyway. So string theory has saved the day with respect to this classical emergency.
Have any more comments?
I'm going to take this question.
But why don't you go on?
Okay.
Is there such a thing as string interaction?
Yes, sure. That's a string interaction. And, you know, there's one of the fundamental processes that I talked to you about was the thing which had an amplitude that was proportional to the string coupling constant, and it's corresponds to two strings joining up. And you can also have, you know, processes where two open strings join up and all sorts of other things, open strings and closed strings and so on and so forth. But the reason I was talking about certain limits of the theory when you can turn off some of these interactions. So just in general, if you allow the coupling constant to be anything, everything will interact with everything else and it'll be a nasty mess. But some of the things that we've learned to do recently are take very special limits of systems, like a bunch of D-grains or something else. And then we, by taking very special well-designed limits, we can turn off some of the interactions, sort of turn them off selectively, so that we can get a system that we can actually control. But for example, when I set up my special limit here that gave rise to a just a supersymmetric gauge theory, nothing else on the brains, and some near-horizon space-time in the 10 dimensions, I had terms, it turns out that in some circumstances this corresponds to turning the string coupling constant to be very small, but just the way that different parameters get combined to make physical parameters can be, you know, arranged so that you still get finite coupling constants in the system of interest, which might be this gauge theory. I guess that's one of the lessons that we learned after the last few years is to take very special well-designed limits so that we can get control of a system in very special circumstances. So that's how, for example, we know what to do with the toenails or the trunk of the elephant or the tail and so on. We've designated those to be very special places where we can control the physics and calculate something. Any more questions?
Okay, well, let's thank the management.